It's The Takeaway for Thursday, October 17th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Today on the show, while domestic violence affects all kinds of people, immigrant women face a unique set of challenges in getting help and support.
Even though they're here, and even when they're somebody who already has status here, that is all something that becomes fragile if they report.
But first, Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland has died at 68.
The greatest gift that you and I, Mr. President, can give to our children is making sure that we give them a democracy that is intact. Democracy better than the one that we came upon.
And that's where we begin.
My father had never been in the Capitol building. He said, isn't this this place where they used to call us slaves? I said, yes, sir. And isn't this the place they used to call us three-fifths of a man? I said, yes, sir. And I'll never forget. He said, when I think about you being someone in the day, he said, now I see what I could have been if I'd had an opportunity.
Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland died today at the age of 68. A spokesperson for the congressman issued a statement saying his death was caused by, quote, complications concerning longstanding health challenges. Representative Cummings was chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform at the time of his death, and he remained an outspoken person in Congress until the end of his life.
We are so much better. We should be able to agree that we will not keep kids in child internment camps indefinitely and hidden away from public view. What country is that?
Joining me now to discuss Representative Cummings' life and legacy is Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour and a political contributor for NBC and MSNBC. Yamiche, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You interacted directly with Elijah Cummings during your time reporting in D.C. Yamiche, what stood out to you about those moments?
I remember first meeting Representative Cummings as a young reporter, learning how to cover Capitol Hill. And there are these big gaggles where reporters go and kind of encircle lawmakers and talk to them and ask them questions. And it can be intimidating to a young reporter like myself or back then. And Representative Cummings used to take me off to the side and explain things to me and talk to me about the news of the day. And what he was doing there was really seeing me as somebody who was trying to serve my country as a journalist, as he was obviously trying to serve his country as a lawmaker, but he also was seeing the fact that I was nervous and that I was learning the ropes. So his compassion really is what stood out to me. And it's the kind of compassion that I think really pushes you to be compassionate to other people, because he didn't have to do that. He was a powerful lawmaker who had a lot on his agenda, but he took time over the years to really be kind to me.
Social media is flooded today with remembrances of Representative Cummings. What do you think his political legacy will be, Yamiche?
His political legacy will be someone who stood up for what he believed in. He was a Democrat who was really hard charging, who was blunt talking. In these times where the Democrats are really in very tense battles with President Trump, he spoke out. I also think, though, in his political legacy is going to be someone who rose above a lot of things, in that he was a sharecropper's son who was told by a counselor that he spoke too poorly to go to college and to become a lawyer. And he not only became a lawyer, but then rose to be one of the most powerful men in the U.S. Congress. So I think his political legacy is also going to be something of an American that was told he wasn't good enough and really proved people wrong.
Yamiche, you've been in the White House and in many contentious reporting gaggles there. What's the mood in D.C. today?
The mood in D.C. today is really tense. The meeting yesterday that divulged into partisan attacks, and Nancy Pelosi saying that the president had a meltdown, and the White House saying that she walked out. And that's really what's happening here. So I think Elijah Cummings' death is really just adding to a solemn mood in D.C. today. And of course, the president's offering his condolences and saying that Elijah Cummings is going to be hard to replace. But it's very clear that he also has called Elijah Cummings a racist. He also said that his district was rodent infested. So it is in some ways a contrast that is so obvious. So I think that is also adding to the mood in D.C. today.
Representative Cummings also served for 2 years as the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus. What can you tell us about the civil rights issues that he was championing during his career?
Well, he was someone who was pushing for equality, pushing for the idea that all Americans should be created equally and should be treated as equal. And he also cared about his district. He lived in inner city Baltimore. His house was broken into once, but he kept that because he wanted to be crowned. And in some ways, he wanted to show his constituents and I would say other lawmakers that he wasn't above the people he was serving.
Yamiche Alcindor is White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Yamiche, thank you.
Thanks.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and according to the CDC, one in four women experience intimate partner violence in the United States. And while domestic violence can affect all kinds of people, immigrant women face a unique set of challenges in getting the help and support that they need. A woman named Rocio was one of them.
I was 14 years old in 1994. I crossed the border undocumented.
Rocio came to the United States from Mexico, and her experience with domestic violence began with her father. She asked that we not use her last name.
When we came to this country, my father was very scared about the police, about ICE, about immigration. So since we came here, we already noticed that he was a person that always was hiding in their house. He didn't allow us to go outside unless we had to. He used to get drunk a lot. And I do remember that he used to hit me when my father used to hit my mom. We never thought about calling the police or something because we always thought if we call the police will call immigration and then we could end up being deported. I never spoke about that with my teachers, my guidance counselor. None of us did it because we knew that the moment we would do it, he will turn against us, and then he will start hitting us, too.
Rocio moved out of her home at the age of 18 with her boyfriend, and soon she was pregnant and married.
At the beginning, he was kind of nice and, like, understanding. But then later on, he started to change a lot. And I didn't recognize that there were different type of abuse. The abuse that I have in my family was definitely physical abuse and verbal abuse. With my husband, I started to have emotional abuse and then economic abuse. And then finally, it was verbal and physical abuse.
Rocio said she began to notice the economic abuse after becoming a naturalized citizen in 2001 and applying for work.
So that's when everything started to change a lot because I was earning double than my husband was earning. And the type of job that I had, it was much better than the jobs that I had previously and even the job that he had. He started to spend money more. He started to get my money. Then he started to force me to pay the rent. You have to pay for the food. Eventually, taking over all my money.
And the physical and emotional abuse escalated, including in front of the couple's children.
When we have a lot of fights, we try to avoid them. We always try to have the fights away from them because I knew that if you see it, it really makes you feel scared because I went through that. Sadly, one day he called them and he made them witness something that he did to me. He was forcing me to kill him, supposedly. And he called them and he said, call 911 because your mother wants to kill me.
Like so many in her position, it took time for Rocio to come to terms with her reality.
At the time, I didn't realize that that was happening. Anybody who didn't like my husband, I was like, okay, so I don't invite them to my house again. And I end up being isolated because I didn't like the fact that people were seeing things that I didn't saw. But it was hard for me to accept that he was not doing things the right way. Like he was using my money, he was using me, and I didn't want to see it at the moment. I grew up with the idea of living with a person until I die. I was like, oh, that's part of marriage. That's okay. and sometimes they might lose control, but that doesn't mean they don't love you. It's just that because of the alcohol. But then when I spoke with my mom and my sister-in-law, they told me that this was not normal, this was not okay. And that's when I decided to leave him. I left on September 23, 2016.
We just heard a survivor of domestic violence who immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico. And now we're going to turn to three specific immigrant communities to understand what survivors face at the intersection of being an immigrant and facing intimate partner violence. And just a note that in our next conversation, you'll hear some of our guests refer to domestic violence as DV. Kavitha Mera is the executive director of SAKI for South Asian Women, serving survivors from the South Asian diaspora facing gender-based violence. Margarita Guzman is the executive director of the Violence Intervention Program, which helps the Latinx immigrant community dealing with domestic and sexual violence. And Zainab Ayega is the executive director of Saudi Yetu, which supports African immigrants and African American women facing domestic violence and other issues. Thanks to you all for being with us.
Thank you for having us here.
Kavitha, let's start with you. What are some of the challenges that domestic violence survivors face in the South Asian community specifically?
If you are a survivor of gender-based violence and if you clearly cannot assimilate because of the color of your skin, or one cannot access healthcare or food or public benefits because of language barriers, that isolation is further exacerbated because navigating through the system is even more challenging for survivors.
Zainab, you immigrated to the United States in the 1990s from mm-hmm. Sudan. You're now primarily working with West African and mm-hmm. North African women. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the experiences that these women have when it comes to domestic violence.
The experience of domestic violence and sexual assault for African women is double-edged sword because they come from countries where systems do not exist to address domestic violence. Domestic violence is considered in many countries as a family matter that is handled within the home. And then when they come here, they don't know the system. The system also does not know them. You know, so for a long time, for example, one of our clients was a DV victim, had been taken to the shelter, but was in a shelter for 3 months where no one was able to communicate with her because they didn't know that she spoke other languages and they didn't get an interpreter for her. So those women bring with them the double, you know, traumas of migration and the double traumas of DV back home and also DV the experience here. And they not only just Black women, but they also immigrant women. So they also have that other double jeopardy of being both immigrant but also Black.
And I was going to ask you about that distinction, because often when we talk about Black women, mm-hmm. we are talking about either women of African descent mm-hmm. or African-American women mm-hmm. or Afro-Latinas, and mm-hmm. the list goes mm-hmm. on. But yeah. the differences here between how African-American women mm-hmm. experience domestic violence mm-hmm. is what? How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think the way African-American women experience DV is a little bit different, partly because they are citizens of this country. They're not immigrants. You know, yes, they do have a long history of racism, Jim Crow, and slavery. But what makes the difference is that African women come into a system that they don't know, and a system where their languages are different, where social support networks don't exist, where the institutional structures don't know about them, versus African Americans, where the institutional structures are there, but the institutional structures actually don't like them. Hmm. And don't protect them. So that's the difference.
Margarita, looking here at the Latino, Latina, Latinx community, we are seeing a big change here in terms of who's coming to the country, why people are coming to the country, the rules permitting women who have experienced domestic violence in Central America, for example, to come to this country. So how is that having an effect on domestic violence victims here today?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges is that while a lot of the immigrants that we're serving who have already arrived to the U.S. Have been able to get past those barriers to getting here and getting to resources, they're also watching as all the people from their countries who are trying to flee violence, often gender-based violence, are being targeted by policies that are specifically anti-Latin American immigrants. And that is telling them that even though they're here, and even when there's somebody who already has status here, that is all something that becomes fragile if they report. You know, as Rocio said when she was talking about, you know, I can go to the police, but then I might get deported. They can't trust this system. And while they might want accountability for the abusive partner, it doesn't necessarily mean they want him to be deported. And those unintended consequences have such a chilling effect and have made it so that people are staying in relationships longer, I think.
And a lot of times when we talk about domestic violence in Latinx communities, it's often associated with machismo, which is, you know, sexism from men towards women. But same-sex domestic violence is real. That was part of the reason you got into this work. Is it a growing problem in the Latinx community?
I think that when it comes to same-gender relationships and same-gender intimate partner violence, it's always been present. It's just that now we are actually acknowledging intimate partner violence as something beyond cisgender male on cisgender female. When I was in my abusive relationship, one of the greatest challenges around it was that we were both people of color. We were both queer. The last place that we were going to go to were the cops, though we both had citizenship privilege as well. When we look for resources, it becomes such a challenge when the larger narrative excludes you as somebody who has been through what you see other people going through. So while I had language for domestic violence, I understood all about DV dynamics, it took me a long time to acknowledge that that was happening in my same gender relationship. So I think that one of the most important things that we can do is to really address what intersectional identities look like.
Margarita, you mentioned Rocio, who we heard at the top of the segment here. I want to get, Kavita, your thoughts on Rocio's testimony. What a lot of what Rocio said ring true with your clients?
Absolutely. We see a significant amount of isolation that our clients will experience. And oftentimes, you know, we have clients who will never have taken the subway before and have somehow garnered access to our helpline number and will call us and we'll have to send a car service for them to be able to get resources and come to our offices. What really is prevalent throughout the South Asian community is this sense of shame and also this deep sense of duty. And the combination of both of those things really holds survivors back from being able to come forward to share their experiences. And so that just exacerbates the isolation that they often will feel.
Zainab, you're nodding your head.
So in hearing Rocio's story, the fear of reporting, the lack of trust for the system, especially the police, is very prevalent. Likewise, as you know what Kavita is saying, the sense of isolation, but also the idea that experiencing DV or being battered at home is a woman's lot, that your mothers went through that. So what are you making a big deal out of it? This is what it means to be a woman. This is what women go through in life. The most important thing for you is to actually be married and maintain your marital home.
Kavita, how many cases of domestic violence are actually reported within the South Asian community?
So the national average for women to experience gender-based violence is 1 in every 3. For the South Asian diaspora here in the U.S., it's 2 in every 5. So what we know, and we also know that it's highly underreported. I think it goes back to this sense of deep sense of shame, this deep sense of duty to the family, and oftentimes the way that DV or sexual violence will play out in the South Asian diaspora is it's familial. So it's in the context of intimate partner violence, but it's also in the context of in-laws inflicting forms of abuse, and the impact of that abuse is much broader.
Zainab, what are some of the biggest obstacles to getting women help? Does it often become a legal battle for your clients as well?
I think it is multiple, as Kavita said, is a multiple barriers and challenges. One is legal. Perpetrators and the powers that be in the communities know how to misinform. And so many of our victims then are held hostage in their homes. But you know, the institutional structures are not also very supportive. For example, you don't have shelters that have multilingual helplines. You don't have frontline staff that are multilingual. So that in itself has, you know, creates barriers. So the systems that we have in place that probably helped victims 10, 15 years ago are no longer systems and policies that actually help the diverse victims in the city. So we need to review some of those systems and structures.
Margarita, earlier this summer, President Trump made various calls, if you will, for raids across the United States. And while, you know, we know that ICE is not solely looking for immigrants of Latino descent, they are the focus of a lot of the rhetoric. They are the focus of a lot of what we see that's happening at the southern border. Did that fear of ICE play into an increased fear in the women that you're working with?
100%. I mean, here in New York City, one of the things that we see is ICE at courts to pick people up in hallways and after they're done with their court hearings. So that's really telling immigrant people that to even petition for the protection that they need in a courthouse is dangerous to them. It's almost like asking one abuser to hold another one accountable. And that's something that people aren't able to risk at this moment in time. And I wanted to note that, you know, Zainab was saying something about language access and not having people who are multilingual to respond. That's true of all of the systems, courts, law enforcement in a huge way, all the mainstream resources that we have available. It's in addition to being able to speak the language, because there's a lot of Spanish speakers. Spanish is like the second most common language after English in the country. And in addition to just having language, there's a cultural sort of connectivity that is brought by organizations like ours, that even if somebody can get an interpreter, they're still going to miss something in that person's story. So I just wanted to note that, like, it's not just the power to tell your story. It's also having the resources to listen accurately and receptively and with cultural humility.
One of the reasons that we know many women stay in abusive relationships is because of the finances. And I'm going to imagine that the finances and the ability to work, the ability to make your own money, the ability to even come here and not depend on a partner to help you is one of the reasons that maybe exacerbates the issue for immigrant women who are facing domestic violence. Kavitha, what do you see that in your community?
We do. So in 2017, we doubled down in really investing in our direct services programs, specifically because we knew that that was our greatest avenue to be able to combat what's coming from the Trump administration and better support survivors from our community. And one of those elements includes expanding our economic empowerment program, where we provide job coaching, job readiness, job placement.
And of course, we know, again, that the Trump administration has tinkered with, if you will, the public charge rule,
right,
that also has an impact on this community. Zainab, mm-hmm. Has that had any effect on your clients?
Absolutely. We actually have seen a drop down in women coming to us for assistance because of the messaging they've been hearing about the public charge, all the other changes that are happening. Even if the policies are not in place, but the notion that they could be in place is a chilling effect in a lot of immigrant communities. So we've seen a drop down in the numbers of women coming to ask for assistance. If they do, they say, I'm not coming to report, but I just need you to let me know about the options. Please don't take my name. So we have people saying, I don't want my IDs to be made copy of. I don't want my name to be written down because I don't trust you guys. If the government comes and asks to see, you will share my information. So that is also happening.
The three of our respective organizations had a drop in numbers between 2017 and 2018.
Yes.
And we accounted for the anti-immigrant rhetoric that's been really exacerbated throughout the national rhetoric.
And along those lines, I mean, one of the policies, at least I guess I would say policy in quotes, that we've seen, particularly along the southern border, Margarita, is family separation happening for a number of different reasons. When you are an immigrant woman who is dealing with domestic violence and you are also a mother, does the current climate also feed into the fear that not only if I report, I'll be deported, but if I report, I don't know where my kids will end up. I don't know where I will end up. Will the government, separate me from my children? Is that now a concern?
Yes, 100%. And some version of family separation has been present in U.S. policies really since the U.S. has been established. But there, the question makes me think of are all of the folks who are already in New York City who are terrified of reporting because they know that Child Protective Services can play a really destructive role in those families. immigration status is always something people know will be read against them, even if that's not on the books. Even if in New York City, we're a sanctuary city, it's about as safe here for an immigrant as it can possibly be in this country. But we know that people walk around with biases and that it's just kind of everyday people who are enacting all of the statutes that are available.
We just want to mention to our listeners that the National Domestic Violence Hotline, that number is 1-800-799-7233. I'd like to thank our guests. Kavita Mira is the executive director of SAKI for South Asian Women. Margarita Guzman is the executive director of Violence Intervention Program. And Zainab Ayega is the executive director of Saudi Yetu, all organizations helping immigrants deal with domestic violence in the United States. Thank you all for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Our team includes producers Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Andres O'Hara. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Our engineers are Vince Fairchild and Claire McKean. Our director and sound designer is Jay Cowett. David Gable is our pie expert and administrative assistant. And Lita Halliwell is our intern. Deirdre Debke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening this and every week. Hope you'll join me again next time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.